Primordial Soup Pot. I'm Rustin, and I'm here with my co-host.
Hey, I'm Aaron.
Every couple of weeks, Aaron and I will get together to talk about some wild and wonderful topic within the incredible world of ecology, evolution, and natural history. And this time around, we're talking about human-animal mutualisms, yeah?
It was mutualisms that was not domestication.
Correct.
That was the caveat to it. Co-workers.
Right. Wild animals. No, so no cows, no crops, no pets, none of those things. Out of curiosity, how did your research go for this episode?
It sucked. I had a tough time with this one. Because it was really hard to find an animal that we utilized that also benefited the animal. That was the key right there.
Yeah, it's that mutually beneficial part that's a bit problematic when you're talking about a topic for this episode.
And the ones that did benefit were almost always domesticated, at least from what I found. But I found some eventually.
Right, that's something of a theme with humans, is that like if we have a really beneficial mutualism, that animal or plant typically becomes domesticated. So it's rare to find like something that really walks that fine line, you know?
Yeah, I think, at least in my perspective, the only way for it to work is for that animal to, maybe it does well in captivity, but it might not breed well. So we can't get the proper numbers to domesticate it.
Yeah, that's a really good, that's a really good litmus test for this episode, I think. For me personally, at least, there was one topic that I really wanted to talk about, but there was another example that I thought about, and maybe you ended up picking it, so I'm not going to talk about it at the current time, but yeah, there were only two that I could really think about, so maybe you found something else.
We're not off to a good start. That's a 50-50 chance.
Well, that's what I could think about, Aaron. You're a crafty fellow. You can come up with another topic.
I found two, but the first one, the more and more I looked at it, it didn't really seem like it benefited the animal. And it was already really stretching it to begin with.
All right. Okay, well, in any case, I think I'm up, so I'll talk about my example. So, the inspiration for this episode, for me at least, was a bird called the Greater Honey Guide. Are you at all familiar?
I think I've heard of it.
Okay. So, the name is a bit of a giveaway, but it's still an utterly fascinating interaction that occurs between this bird and tribal African people. So, the Greater Honey Guide is a medium-large size songbird. For North American audiences, it's roughly the size of a cardinal. And it lives on the African savanna, specifically the East African savanna. So, Tanzania, Kenya, Mozambique, that kind of area. And the adults are mostly brown and white, although they do have yellow wing patches and a pink beak. The juveniles actually look dramatically different. They have these yellow bellies and this distinct white ring around their eye, both of which are absent in the adults. So they undergo a significant change in plumage when they transition into adulthood. As for their diet, they mostly eat insects, often by fly catching, with termites being a favorite of theirs. Other times they will follow herds of large animals, which of course are very prevalent on the African savanna, and catch the insects scared up as the herd moves through the grass and the brush.
They don't pick the flies off of them?
No, that's not really their thing. They'll do that sometimes, but usually they try and stay further away from, you know, the larger animals. They're not like oxpeckers in that regard, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They generally like to stay away from the large animals, except for people, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So, thus far, there's nothing about this species which really indicates a special relationship with humans, right?
Nothing so far.
Here's the thing. The vast majority of a honey guide's diet is made up not of insects, but upon beeswax. And they can't open up the beehives to extract the beeswax on their own. people love the honey produced by the bees, but have trouble finding the nests.
I'm sorry, did you say it's called the honey guide or the honey guide?
Honey guide.
Okay.
So, by this point, you might have already guessed the nature of their relationship with humans. There are slight variations to honey guide human interactions throughout different parts of Africa, but generally they work like this. So, honey hunters will exclaim with a distinct call to attract the birds. The honey guides, instead of thinking that the humans are weird or crazy, recognize the call and fly toward the humans, and they produce this chattering sound to get the human's attention when they get near to the human. The honey guides then literally guide the humans to the honey, in this case within a beehive in a tree, and they're able to find these hives so easily because of their incredible sense of smell. This allows them to detect the hives not just based on the honey, but on the smell of beeswax, which is odorless to humans. So actually in their native range, if you just stick like a piece of beeswax to a tree, a honey guide will find it and start eating it.
Huh. Good sense of smell.
Right. They're really, really good at finding the stuff. It's a really good sense of smell, especially for birds, which are not really known for having good senses of smell. At least overall. There are exceptions, but in general.
I have a question. You said they eat the wax.
Yes, the wax.
Why not the honey?
I'll get to that. But they focus on the wax and also the larvae.
Okay. In the nest. I know that's high in protein.
Yes, yes.
Actually, I think I read once that bears, although they like the honey, it's really the protein from the larva that they need.
Yep, yep. But anyway, so the honey guides keep chattering the whole time while they're leading the humans on this kind of expedition. And when the hive is near, the birds go silent, which is a signal to the humans that they really got to start looking around for the hive. So they'll just go quiet and perch right near the hive. And once the hive has been located by the humans, the people will then light a fire or torch and use the smoke to calm the bees, which is a common practice in a lot of apiaries. The difference here is that the hunters have to place the smoke right near a hive, about 30 feet off the ground in a tree, without the fire catching to other trees and burning the whole area down. So it's a little bit more complicated, and it takes some skill. But once the bees are calm, the humans crack open the hive and collect the honey, right? And with the hive cracked open, the birds can feed on the larvae and the wax inside the hive. And what's also worth noting is that they are one of a small number of bird species which can actually digest the wax. Other bird species do feed on wax, but it's a really, really uncommon trait. The honey guides actually have a special enzyme in their digestive system, which allows them to break down the beeswax.
It actually seems to be fairly rare in many animals, because I know there's a couple specialists that will feed on beeswax.
Yeah, yeah. The stuff is generally pretty indigestible, but not for the honey guides. So the end result of this whole interaction is a feast for both the human and the honey guide. Of course, this interaction is vital for the honey guide since they mostly feed on the beeswax. However, it's also really important for people too. By some estimates in these tribes which practice honey hunting, the honey can make up about 10% of their overall diet, which is not insignificant at all.
Is this a dying practice?
Yes. I'll talk more about that later.
Okay.
So, this interaction is known to be at least 500 years old, at least based on Western accounts. The first Western account is actually pretty hilarious. The first European to mention the honey guides was a Portuguese missionary in the 1500s who noticed that these weird birds kept coming into his church to eat the candles because the candles were made of beeswax. So he kept trying to scare away these birds, and they kept coming back to eat all his candles.
And then there's a very disappointed tribe walking into the church as well.
Right, exactly. So he actually got kind of pissed off about this. So he did some investigating and found out about this whole interaction between the honey guides and the local tribes, and ended up writing a description of it. And that's the first that Europeans ever knew about this. However, it is likely much, much older than that. It is thought to be at least a millennia old. And what's crazy is that there are some estimates which even date this practice back to the days of Homo erectus. In other words, before modern humans even existed. So this practice could possibly be millions of years old, which is really, really fascinating to think about overall. Anyway, what's also fascinating about this interaction is how each species learns the signals involved. So humans and birds have very different forms of communication. Like, we communicate vocally and through hearing, but the way we produce those sounds and the sounds that we produce often are different and are interpreted very differently. So the fact that humans and birds are able to communicate in this way is really remarkable if you think about it. For humans, the learning process is probably about what you'd expect. You know, children learn the calls from their parents and the others in their tribe, and then the traditions are then passed down from generation to generation. However, the signals used to attract the honey guides are different in different areas. So for each part of the honey guide's range, there's a different type of call. And actually, I can play an example for you right now.
It's the bird?
So in that recording, the chattering in the background was the bird?
And the first... Brrr. That was a man, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a person.
Whoops.
But...
I was going to say, it sounded remarkably human.
Yeah, that's because it was human, Aaron. But yeah, so that's just one example, right? In some areas, the hunters produce a trill like that. In other areas, it's more of a whistle. And in still other areas, the hunters actually carve shells so that the shell itself acts like a little honey guide horn when you blow it. So there are a lot of different ways that people use to signal to these birds. It's not just one specific call that has, you know, expanded across the honey guide's range. They use a whole different set of signals. As for the honey guides, it's somewhat more complicated because honey guides are actually brood parasites. And I discussed this practice a bit in the last episode with the Kirtland's warbler, but as a refresher, they lay their eggs in the nest of another bird and then let those parents raise their young. The honey guide chick will then outcompete the others in the nest, who often die, and the honey guide chick will then survive to adulthood. So there's basically no parental investment on the part of the honey guide. And honey guides will actually take this a step further because they actually hatch with really, really sharp beaks that they use to stab and slash the other chicks in the nest. So they're even more brutal than the species that we have here in North America, like cowbirds. So they're quite intense about it. But in any case, this means that the juvenile honey guides don't learn the honey hunting calls of humans from their parents. They have to learn different calls in different areas, basically without any kind of parenting, right? Because they just grow up in another bird's nest and then they're off doing their own thing. So how do they learn these signals, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is possible that juvenile birds learn the behavior from their elders. So more than one honey guide shows up to a cracked open beehive to feast because that's a lot of food. So it's possible that the younger birds show up to the party and kind of pick up on the calls over time. So basically they just kind of get into the habit of showing up to these, you know, opened beehives, and then they see the older birds responding to these calls that the humans are making, and then eventually they know that when the humans make that call, they're going to look for a beehive, and then that's basically how the practice gets carried on from generation to generation without parents teaching their chicks. And this would also make sense given the fact that juvenile birds don't participate in these hunting expeditions at all. It's only the adults. to the point that local tribes actually consider the juveniles a totally different species because of their appearance, in addition to the fact that they don't participate in honey hunting. But all that is pure speculation. The true nature of the learning behavior for the birds isn't fully understood and largely remains a mystery. So it's really fascinating to think about how a chick grows up basically in a foster nest and then winds up learning this really, really, if you think about it, a really complicated set of signals, at least for a bird, and this really remarkable mutualism with people. Regardless, it remains a truly fascinating example of cooperation between humans and wild animals.
And do they do this exclusively with humans?
Most of the research that I found was around humans. There is some evidence to suggest that honey guides will partner with other animals as well, but nothing definitive that I could find. So we don't really know. Obviously, most of our knowledge comes from the human side of things. But like I said, this is also kind of a dying practice as well, because of a lot of different factors. One being deforestation. Their habitats are decreasing. Their forests are being cut down. So the beehives where they like to feed are also disappearing. The other thing, too, is that honey is becoming more and more readily available through, you know, commercial means and through apiaries and things like that.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Right, the practice of honey hunting itself is kind of declining because of that as well. So, really, it's just a few tribes in East Africa that are still practicing this particular mutualism, or are still involved in this mutualism with the honey guides. But they still do it, and in a lot of cases, they actually do it pretty much unimpeded on nature preserves, because their practice is so vital for the survival of the honey guides. So they just let these tribes continue honey hunting on protected land, because it, you know, it's beneficial for the birds and it's beneficial for the environment as a whole. There's some protected areas where it still continues, but on the whole, it's declined a lot in the last century or two.
I would imagine, especially even if tribes aren't purchasing honey, it's becoming a lot cheaper to just, you know, set up an apiary, and bees are domesticated.
Right, right. The other thing, too, is that the honey that comes from these wild beehives apparently tastes very different from the honey you would get from an apiary. So if you think about this, like, on a consumer level, if people are used to a certain kind of flavor of honey that comes from a, you know, a domesticated apiary, and then they try honey from a wild hive, and it tastes totally different, you know, it takes some time for that, like, palate to kind of develop within the consumer. So there is a certain amount of adjustment that has that occurs there as well.
Yeah, but one's a lot more convenient. I mean, when I'm enjoying a cup of tea and, you know, I need a little sweetener for it, I don't go probing around outside for a bird to guide me to a hive. I'd much rather just squeeze it out of the little bear.
Right, right. You don't walk outside and go,
Or I think I could if I wanted to.
Well, no, you couldn't, because we don't have honey guides around here. But if you were in East Africa, I still don't know that you would. Regardless, it's still a really, really cool interaction, and a really unique interaction in a lot of ways that is really worth studying and was really fascinating to read about as well.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, with the honey guides, as the practice sort of dissolves, it's already kind of old-fashioned at this point, I imagine, or it's a dying practice, like you said. What happens to the honey guides? Do they need the beeswax, or are they able to kind of adjust to not rely on it as much?
I think they're able to adjust, but it's obviously a shock to them. Like, they still eat insects, and they've been known to, you know, fly catch, like I mentioned at the beginning of the piece, but that doesn't change the fact that the vast majority of their diet comes from beeswax. So that's still a really large shift for them. Like I also alluded to, it's possible that they have partnerships with other animals and can kind of adapt in that way. But on the whole, the loss of this practice is definitely a blow for the honey guides.
Yeah, I imagine. It sounds like they worked really hard to carve out this niche that once it's gone, it's kind of hard to rebound from that. It must have taken a very long time for this behavior and well, the behavior for one thing to evolve, and another thing, just the physical adaptations, being able to digest the wax.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, that's kind of an issue with a lot of, like, a lot of human actions. You know, we kind of, obviously people have this tendency to go in and change environments and break things, and we're breaking things that we don't even fully understand in a lot of cases, you know, like, there are all these really remarkable interactions that took millions and millions of years to evolve that we just don't know about, that we're interfering with without even knowing it. Obviously there are people involved in this particular interaction, but in terms of Western society, it was really unknown until 500 years ago, which is, in the course of this interaction, is relatively recent.
Yeah.
So,
do you think the honey guides are capable of recognizing individual people? Because I'm wondering, like, what if, you know, what if one comes, it's like, ah, man, it's this guy. And, like, he's really bad at this. You know, they did warm versus cold for, like, half an hour earlier, and he still didn't find the nest.
I sat right next to the damn thing, and he still couldn't find it.
yeah, like, I'm wondering if they kind of... Obviously, like, you'd have to set up a... it'd be really hard to study this. It'd be cool, though, to see if they could recognize individual people and maybe kind of bail if they're really bad at getting the honey.
So I don't know about specific people. That would be a really, really interesting thing to look into. But what they have done, they did this really fascinating study where they took recorded calls, like the one I played for you, and then they played it in that tribe's, you know, area, and then they, like, and they tested the success of that call based on honey guide calls from other areas. And they found that the calls from that local area were vastly more successful in terms of summoning a honey guide. And all the calls were more successful in summoning a honey guide than just normal human noises. So it's not like the birds are just naturally attracted to people. They're attracted to people who make that specific call because that's the signal that, hey, these people are going to want to hunt some honey. I don't know if that answers your question at all.
I mean, I don't think my question was answered. I think we'd have to do a bit more studying. But yeah, it makes sense that there's localities to it. Or at least it's interesting that there is.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really, again, it's really fascinating to think about because these signals are different in different areas. So they kind of occurred, that indicates that they occurred separately. You know, there aren't really many similarities between some of these calls. So the honey guide human interaction has evolved separately in a lot of different areas, which speaks to its, you know, beneficial nature to both sides.
You ever think about letting one loose in a Yankee Candle factory? Because you mentioned they were eating the candles earlier.
You know, I honestly, I think that would be torture for the honey guides because they could smell the candle wax, but it's all encased in glass. So they can't access it. They have all the wax in the world to eat and none of it is accessible.
They'd probably try and, like, signal one of the guys on the night shift. You know, probably like a janitor, getting the crack one open for him.
Maybe, but I mean, that's kind of like putting, like, a whole bunch of candy in front of a child, but the candy's in a childproof jar and the kid just can't figure out how to open the damn thing and just gets really frustrated and starts crying. Like, yeah, it just sounds like a really bad time for the honey guides.
Yeah, maybe.
Then again, if you left all the caps off, that just becomes heaven.
Yeah, maybe they could establish in there. Oh, but no, they're brood parasites. They couldn't.
No, you'd have to have other birds in there too. So you'd have to set up a bird feeder and a bunch of candles. But that would make it a very weird shop.
It would be. Now I'm wondering if we could sustain them off of paraffin.
You know, I'm not sure.
On an even deeper level, I know that some of the moths that can eat beeswax, or their larvae that can, have enzymes that can also be used to digest plastic. So maybe a steady diet of styrofoam works out for them.
I don't think it goes that far for the honey guys.
Probably honestly. Not.
But, yeah, who knows? It might.
Yeah. In that case, things are going to be working out great for them in a little bit. Plastics everywhere.
Yeah, but I wouldn't hold out much hope.
All right. Well, regardless, that was a really cool piece.
Thank you.
I figured it was going to be something bird related, because
yeah,
there's only so many animals we can really form relationships with.
Yeah, that was a good guess. It was pretty much always going to be like a bird or a mammal.
Yes,
unless it was somehow some kind of plant. But if it was a plant, it wouldn't meet the requirements because that plant probably got domesticated.
Now, what if I told you I picked neither?
Did you pick a fungus?
No, I didn't pick a fungus. Although, with that, I guess it's not domesticated. For that matter, cheese, you know?
Yeah.
Or like so many different foods. I didn't even think of that route.
Yeah, I guess you could have talked about yeast, technically. It's really hard to train a microbe.
You can't really domesticate them. They do what they want. But no. So for this topic, I'm actually going to be discussing freshwater mussels.
Really? That is not the direction I expected you to go.
It's not what I expected either. I kind of hopped around. I tried to read, like, you know, I think I read somewhere that there's a tribe that hunts with dolphins, but it's like, yeah, not a lot of information on that reliability. But no, I'll be talking about freshwater mussels, and in particular, the usage of them in Poland's water treatment facilities.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, this is cool. So, first off, discuss what a mussel is. These guys are a mollusk in the bivalve class. And bivalves are all organisms that have two shells that they can open and shut, and they got all the ooey organ bits on the inside. So clams, oysters, scallops, mussels, these are all bivalves, except barnacles. Barnacles aren't bivalves. I didn't know that for a long time. They're actually crustaceans, closely related to crabs.
Right. So basically, if you've ever tried to eat something in a shell at a restaurant and have looked at half a shell and found nothing in it, looked at the other half and found the actual edible bit in it, it's a bivalve.
It's a bivalve. So, of course, mussels are found across the globe in a variety of environments. There are plenty of marine and brackish species, but some of the richest diversity actually comes from freshwater. Mussels are filter feeders, meaning that they have siphons that draw water into the body. They remove edible bits suspended in the water column and eject it out. So this simple act of feeding is actually critical to the health of many different environments. I'm going to briefly touch on why they're important, but really that's a topic for another day. But the act of filter feeding removes nutrients and plankton from the water. And when they do this, they sort of take this food source that is suspended in the water column and convert it into a solid form that can be used by plants and animals. So they have a really key role of taking all these little food bits in the water and making it available to everything else.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's really incredible, honestly. And if you ever want an idea of just how different bivalves are from people, imagine what it would look like if you just saw a dude sitting on the side of a river, like, just sucking water in and then spitting it back out again. That's basically what a bivalve does all day.
Imagine if a raccoon just cracked open his rib cage and started scooping out bits and eating it too.
Well, that would actually be fairly standard for a raccoon. I would not be surprised by that.
To a person?
No, wouldn't be surprised.
Raccoons are different from where you're from.
Hey, man. Raccoons in cities are different, man. They're different.
No kidding. So in addition to the roles they play in reducing the turbidity of water, this can also allow for more submerged plant life to grow on the bottom. So the cloudier the water is, the less plant life or seaweed you can have growing on the bottom. The sunlight doesn't penetrate through. So in a lot of environments, mussels are key to keeping that water clarity. In fact, in some environments, there's some invasive species, the clarity of the water is actually too high. It's much higher than it was historically. The environment was always like that, which isn't necessarily a good thing. Some species of mussels can also build up reefs, which acts as an amazing habitat for a huge amount of animals. Again, think the Chesapeake Bay. There used to be massive oyster beds everywhere, and this attracts so many different fish, crabs, worms, invertebrates. Great habitat. And of course, by filtering the water, they can also remove pollutants or excess nutrients and just improve the overall health of the ecosystem. That being said, many mussels are threatened across the globe as well. This also happens to be most of the freshwater species. This could be from more common reasons like pollution or climate change. be from competition with invasive species like the Chinese or the zebra mussels, or it can be various industries that have exploited them for food, pearls, their shells, etc. The mussels have not had a great time, especially when it comes to their relationship with people. But I'm not going to be talking about any of that. I'm going to be talking about the one simple but very useful factor of their behavior and how we can utilize it for water testing. So, if you're a mussel and there's something in the water you don't like, what do you do? You don't have to overthink this.
You die?
Okay, like maybe a step before that. There's something in the water you don't like.
Do you just close, like, do you open up? Or do you close up?
The opposite of that. You close. That's it.
Really?
I mean, what else can you do? You're a mussel. Have you seen a mussel before?
I have, but I mean, you could just sit there and die. Like,
yeah, I think they're going to try to avoid that personally, if it was me, at least.
Well, I was also thinking about, like, oysters in the Chesapeake Bay, which can start, like, dissolving their own shells in low oxygen conditions. So I was thinking along those lines. Like, do they, like, start dissolving their shells like oysters do? But
No.
It was a lot simpler than that. So
if a big fish comes by, a potential predator, you shut. If there's something in the water you don't like, you shut. It's the only thing they can do. I mean, it's like the only thing they have going for them. If the tide is low and you're submerged, you close. That's what mussels do.
To be fair, they're very good at it. They do have very strong opening and closing muscles.
Yeah.
So you have to give them that.
Yeah, I'll give them that. Most mussel species are stationary. Once they pick a spot, that's more or less where they'll be for the rest of their lives. Some species will actually secrete a strong thread-like substance that will anchor them to that spot, so they're not leaving. Once they're in a spot, they're there. That's why when they reproduce, they just make tons of offspring in the hopes that, like, a couple of them find a good spot, can anchor, and then grow there.
They got their 30-year mortgage at a really solid interest rate. They ain't going anywhere.
Oh, yeah, they're from the boomer generation. I believe the memes say they bought their house for a handful of raspberries. Anyways, so mussels, like I said, also happen to be sensitive to pollutants. So if there's some in the water they don't like, they shut. And it's because of this very simple behavior that scientists in Poland actually use the mussels to determine the safety of the water treatment plant. I mean, mussels are good. You got to keep in mind, they have a very low metabolism, right? They're not moving, really, ever. So if the supply is tainted, it's better to just close off and wait it out.
Sure, I guess. But my question then is, how do they know that the water composition has changed? Like, how do they know when to open up again?
Well, they have a very wide variety of chemosensors, so they can detect a lot of pollutants in the water. I mean, the exact mechanisms of how they detect everything, I can't tell you that, but I can tell you they're good at it.
Hmm. Okay. I'll take your word for it.
So the water treatment plant that utilizes these is found in Poznan, which is a city in western Poland. The water treatment plant gets its water from the Warta River. This is one of the larger rivers in Poland. And unfortunately, because it's one of the larger rivers, it has many large urban and industrial centers that are built around it, as most large rivers do, meaning that it is very prone to heavy metal contamination. For example, at one time, there were very high levels of chromium. Another example, mercury. A lot of heavy metals can easily make their way into drinking water, and it can be very difficult to remove them. Organic molecules are fairly easier to maintain or treat. Heavy metals are not. They don't break down. They just stay as the metal. While there are a variety of mechanical and chemical sensors that can detect these toxic metals, the mussels are both cheaper and a lot more reliable. So I already mentioned this. Well, they're extremely sensitive to pollutants. That's a major reason for mussel decline worldwide. If they sense anything, they close their shells.
Sure. I'm just surprised that they're that much more reliable than, like, the best chemical sensors that we have available.
So the staff at the treatment facility have said that they work just as well as the fancy electronic equipment and they can detect multiple things at once. And they're a lot cheaper to maintain.
That's crazy. I'm just imagining like a scientist going up to like a body of water and instead of sticking in, you know, like a YSI or something like that, he instead just like throws in like a bowl full of mussels and just watches them as they fall down to the bottom.
It's actually, I won't say it's simpler than that, but the system they use with the mussels is very simple.
Okay.
So you'll probably think there's like some advanced scanner or like some sort of live camera that they're always watching the mussels. That's not what they're doing. They attach a small magnet at the end of a spring. They hot glue it to the mussel's shell and they put it on a little pedestal. Yeah, so you might think it's like a live stream or they have someone around the clock just monitoring the mussels. It's nothing like that at all. So all the researchers do is they attach a small magnet at the end of a spring and they hot glue the spring to the top of the mussel's shell. They put them on a little pedestal and of course they have to measure the gap of how much they'll open when they're feeding. And that's it. So when the mussels close, the spring goes down and the magnet hits a sensor and it lets the system know that the mussels are closed.
Okay, that's still pretty cool.
It's still pretty cool, but it's a lot simpler than you think.
Yeah, yeah, but
they don't have like a mussel technician watching them around the clock.
But you made it sound like there's just like they just like dump the mussels in a pool and then like come back a few hours later and have some drunk guy look at them and go, oh, yeah, those mussels look like they're really close right now. I think the water's bad. Like, that's what I was expecting.
Those mussels are... Yeah, they actually had a service where they would provide these mussels to test your water, and a lot of people use it in their pools. Kept killing them. Why? The pools were full of chlorine.
Wait, people...
No, I made that up. That didn't happen.
Okay.
No, but that's it. That's really the whole system. So, to clear a couple things up, it is not just one mussel. It's not like there's a single mussel working around the clock.
It's a lot of pressure on one mussel. They get stage fright.
Yeah. Oh, it would. That's why there's eight of them working all at once. So in case, yeah. So in case one muscle is just sleepy or maybe it just doesn't feel like opening it up today, it won't throw off the whole system. If one is like a little tired or maybe just it dies, it's not going to shut off the water supply to an entire city. No, you need four of them to close at once, minimum. And number two, this is not the only sensor. It's not like this is like all they have in the facility. This is one of the most important water treatment plants in the country. So they have several systems, backups, and fail safes. But the mussels happen to be some of the most reliable tests. So they use them. So backups are important because maybe someone is walking by the tanks. Maybe there's like a kid on a field trip and starts pounding on the glass. All the mussels freak out and shut. It's not going to cut off the entire water supply. There's other systems in place.
Okay. All right.
And for the mussels, after 3 months of service, they're actually returned to the wild. This is because they eventually become resistant to the pollutants and they no longer react as well. And then new ones are put in their place.
Okay, so then here's my question. Where do they get these mussels that are sensitive to the pollutants?
So they have, they don't reveal all these locations, obviously, but they have a malacologist on staff and his job, or her job, their job, is to locate the mussels, find the supply of them in the wild, where they're in a stream or a lake or maybe a pond with very little pollution, obtain them, use them for a couple months, and then return them to another safe place where they can continue to reproduce, make more mussels. So they have someone whose sole job is to source and manage the mussels.
Seems like kind of a cool gig, honestly.
And you know, yeah, drive around the country looking for mussels. Probably spend it most like beautiful countryside, untainted streams.
Yeah.
Be great.
I'd like that job.
I'd take that job. As far as animal-human relationships go, I'd say it works out pretty good for both parties. The humans get an accurate way of detecting pollutants in the water, and the mussel gets a semester abroad. I mean, it doesn't hurt the mussels.
The only thing there is that generally when you when you get the semester abroad, you know, you consent to going. I don't know that the muscles are doing that.
Okay, at least they don't have to worry about predators. And when you're a muscle, you're easy pickings. Okay,
that's what you should have led with, and not the semester abroad.
I mean, for a muscle, if you're kept in a aquarium, I mean, as long as you have a steady flow of water, I don't think the muscle cares. You know, it's not like a fish. It doesn't need stimulus. It doesn't need places to hide and things to look at. It's a muscle. So this is very similar to the canary in the coal mine, if you're familiar with that, which is when miners would bring canaries in the mines because the birds have a much higher rate of respiration. So they would faint from carbon monoxide poisoning before the miners would. So this would give them time to retreat to the surface.
Right.
Except
that it's a bit more humane than that, because the mussels aren't dying. Like, the canary in the coal mine would like faint and die.
So I did read that sometimes they had their own special enclosure with a little oxygen supply so they could be revived after they fainted.
Oh, okay. That's nice.
So I guess they got attached to canaries, or maybe canaries were just hard to come by.
Okay, all these years I thought that they were just killing canaries in coal mines all the time.
I mean, I'm sure some of them did. Yeah. I didn't say all of them did, I just said some of them.
Right, that's my point. I thought it was all of them.
It might just be one or two, like, really ethical mines, and they care about their canaries. It's like a family-owned operation. These animals are sometimes known as sentinel species, and they essentially act as warnings for contamination or disease in humans. Usually it doesn't work out too great for the animal. One example I found was cats being fed fish before people, because the cats would develop neurological conditions from potential mercury poisoning before the people would. They were sometimes known as dancing cats. Yeah, so it was like, you know, you feed it to them, make sure it's okay.
So these were dancing cats, not to be confused with the musical Cats, which has dancing cats.
No, but if you looked at the script for that, the writer might as well have been on mercury.
Honestly, yeah.
I mean, at least the whole production team for the 2019 rendition. And maybe the play itself was good. I only saw the recent movie.
I will say that some of the songs from the play itself are good, but God, that movie was a piece of garbage. I don't know how they got Judi Dench and Ian McKellen to be in that movie. And Idris Elba.
Taylor Swift!
Yeah, her too. Yeah, wow.
What time to be alive. Anyway, so
Rebel Wilson I wasn't that surprised by.
Yeah, like there's one or two. What's his name? Corden?
Oh, yeah, that was an upgrade for him.
That was his big moment. That was his big moment. He's done more famous things than that. I'm not a fan particularly.
Me either.
I've seen the clips of him where he does like a whole song and dance at a red light for like cars stuck in traffic. Might have been for like it was for a talk show. And I'm sure they get people to fill out consent forms and everything, but man, I would hate that. On my 9-to-5 commute, I would not be in the mood.
See, this is how you know that this man is really, really unpopular, because that wasn't for a talk show. That was for his talk show.
It wasn't a regular thing, was it? It was just a one-time thing, right?
No, that was a regular thing. He did that multiple times. It was a bit.
Oh my God.
It was called Carpool Karaoke, and that was like the most popular bit he had on his talk show.
No, I saw that, but like he stopped traffic. Like he did it at a red light and he had like a whole crew. They're all singing and dancing.
Oh, I missed that one. But yeah, that was for his talk show. Unsurprisingly, it's not on the air anymore.
Anyways, so these mussels are actually not held at the water treatment plant itself. They're actually held in the middle of the Warta River. It's kind of cool. It's this weird, like, circular building just in the middle of the river, kind of sticking up like a weird lighthouse. And it acts as that facility is just to test the water. It's just a detection center. So the idea is by the time that facility picks up any problems with the water, that water will not yet have reached the treatment, which is downstream. So they can shut everything off temporarily, is a warning system. To this date, I don't believe there's actually ever been a high enough contamination to shut down the entire plant. But like I said, given how urbanized the area is, it's very important to have it.
Right. So they have this upstream of the treatment plant. Do they also have it test? Do they also have a similar system set up to test the water that's coming out of the treatment plant?
I'm sure they do. I mean, it's a modern water treatment plant. I'm sure they have many testing sites. But the idea of this is to be an early warning system, so they can know what the water is going to be like in real time before it even reaches the treatment center.
Right. Right. Okay. Okay, I got you.
If you're interested, there's a popular documentary on these mussels known as Graba Kaska, which translates to Fat Kathy. I think it's named after a famous well in Poland.
Okay.
I couldn't find the documentary anywhere. I could only find the trailer for it. It was like a film festival. It's kind of more of an artsy thing. But most of the articles I read cited it.
Huh. Okay.
If you do want to see more about it, there's a short YouTube video by Tom Scott on the subject. And he goes and he interviews a couple of the scientists about the process. It's kind of funny. In the translation, they actually describe the mussels as colleagues. Which is kind of funny. They respect them.
Yeah, that's actually kind of sweet of them, honestly.
So yeah, there's a water testing plant that relies on 8 mussels, some magnets, and a hot glue gun to determine water safety. And it happens to work just as well as some of the most advanced computers and sensing equipment. And that's my piece.
Awesome. So basically, MacGyver found a mussel and used it to test water. And it turned out to be far more effective than like mechanical water quality testing methods.
I mean, I'm sure there's some really advanced sensing equipment, but if the mussel works just as well and it really doesn't cost much to maintain them, why not have both?
Right, right. Fair enough. Fair enough. That's really cool. Yeah, I knew about indicator species that they used to kind of get a general idea of water quality, but I had no idea that they were used in that specific of a context. So that's really interesting.
So what made me the most interested is this is actually fairly recent.
Really?
The way they described this, I thought for certain, like, they probably figured this out a long time ago, and maybe it's been going on since, like, you know, the 50s. No, this was set up in, like, the 90s.
Huh. So it's kind of like the polar opposite of my piece, where my interaction has been going on for millennia, probably, and yours has only been around since yours has been around as long as Friends has.
Yeah, it feels like it should be a lot older, but it's not. I mean, like you said, mussels have been indicator species, but that usually involves like a scientist or technician going out into the field and surveying their populations.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's a lot, there's a lot more involved there, a lot more field work. All right, cool. So, what are you thinking about for the next episode?
I had a couple ideas. So, one that I was thinking we could do a plant episode again. It was like on the fence. I found one or two cool plants. We could do a weird diet episode.
Weird diet?
I wasn't quite sure how to call it, or you could do like a weird niche. There's some animals that eat weird things. I mean, you just talked about a bird that ate
beeswax,
and occasionally candles. So I think there's certainly room to expand on that.
You know what? We haven't talked about a lot of plants. I think another plant episode.
Okay. Is there a specific plant you had in mind, or we'll just do a non-carnivorous plant one?
Just a plant episode. I didn't really have a specific one in mind, but I want to find out about some cool plants for the next episode.
All right, we'll do plants. There's plenty of cool plants out there. It's just neither of us are huge plant guys.
Right, but we can become huge plant guys, Aaron.
Hey, for 50 minutes, we'll be the biggest plant guys on the planet.
We will try. All right, that sounds great. So, you want to take us out?
Yep. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a follow or review on your podcast app of choice. And if you have a suggestion for a future episode, you can reach us at SoupPotPodcast on X or theprimordialsouppot@gmail.com.
All right. And until next time, I'm Rustin.
And I'm Aaron.
See ya.